Welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, June 4th, 2018. And this is the episode of the week, which we have come to know and love as the Top of the Pile. Of course, every week on the Top of the Pile, I discuss some of the books that I read from this past new comic book day. And there are quite a few this week. In fact, this is the first week in quite a while where there are no DC or Marvel books on the Top of the Pile. Now, that's not to say that I did not read Marvel or DC. Matter of fact, I read a bunch of it, and the majority of what I read was great. And I know some of you are a little upset that I'm not talking about Aquaman Jabberjaw or the Black Lightning Kong Kong Fooey books. I'm not going to do that today. I want to make this kind of an all-indie episode. With that said, this past week was the first issue of Man of Steel number 1, the first full issue on the new series by Brian Michael Bendis. And I'm not going to talk in depth about the book. I was a little taken aback. I want to give the book a little more time to breathe in my head to see if I can understand what it is that's happening. There's some great things to love. There's some stuff that I did not like as much, but I'm not going to be talking about that book today. I'll probably wait until the second issue comes out, which it's a weekly book, so it'll be next week, before I can get a grasp on what's happening and before I feel like I have enough information to talk about it. I generally don't like talking about huge books like this just based on first impressions. That's kind of why I haven't talked on every episode about Justice League No Justice. Even though by now, I guess we do have a lot more on that based on Metal and the Mini. The new book does come out this week as well. So I'll probably be talking about the whole Justice League stuff at some point in the near future. But no Man of Steel today. If you want to get it with me on Twitter, I'll be happy to talk to you about it. But I'll probably be waiting a couple weeks before I actually talk about that book. With that said, let's get on to Top of the Pile. This week, we have quite a varied distribution of books. We have one Image, one Valiant, one Aftershock, one Titan, one Albatross, one Dark Horse, and one IDW. That's probably the most publishers that I've hit in one episode since I started doing Top of the Pile. So I'm very excited to talk about these books. I'm going to kick things off with a returning entry into Top of the Pile, and that is Hillbilly number 10 from Albatross. That's written and illustrated by Eric Powell. And I'm not going to go in depth on this one because I think I've talked about this a couple of times before. And I generally don't like to repeat myself on these Top of the Pile episodes. But Hillbilly number 10 obviously follows directly from issue with what happened at the end of issue 9. And what I like about this book, that it's finally back on schedule. We're getting, this is I think the second book that we're getting on a monthly consistent basis after Hillbilly kind of disappeared for almost a year. And it's very cool to see it back. This issue is basically a setup for this upcoming Witch War that was hinted at in the previous issue. And this book continues to be gorgeous. I absolutely love this book. It's not quite a horror book, although obviously there's a lot of horror elements because the main character is a witch hunter. But we're seeing all the previous supporting characters of the series kind of pop back in and join the main character in his quest to stop this witch war that's about to brew. And there's a ton of humor in this particular issue, which I don't think we've seen a lot of humor for a few issues in this series. There is quite a bit of it. In fact, one of my favorite parts of this is these three guys in a town that don't believe the witches are coming until they actually show up to the town and are carrying people off into the sky. It was pretty funny. I'm not going to go line by line what was said, but thoroughly enjoyed it. Hillbilly is one of those things where I don't think it does extremely well, although I think Eric Powell has made a name for himself with this series. And, you know, he self-publishes it. It's kind of like with Terry Moore, right? Where he's got his own little universe that he gets to play around with. Eric Powell has the same thing. And if you've never read a Hillbilly issue, I highly recommend you pick it up. Again, it's only 10 issues in, but it's tons of fun. The art is gorgeous, and thoroughly enjoyed it. So Hillbilly, great start to the Top of the Pile this week. It's going to be a 4 out of 5 for me. From then, I want to move to a book that I had talked about a couple weeks ago, but I didn't actually discuss it in the Top of the Pile. The reason for that is the place where I was getting this book from did not have it in stock at the time. Fortunately for me, they did get it for me the week after. And now the second issue is out. And that book is The Prisoner. This is from Titan Comics, written by Peter Milligan, with art by Colin Lorimer, colors by Joanna LaFuente, and letters by Simon Bolin. That guy, man, I'm telling you, he's everywhere. Now, if you remember from that episode, it was, I believe it was a Comic Predictor episode, actually. I talked about this. The Prisoner is based on a TV show from the 60s that only ran, I think, one season. And this is a super interesting update to the series. You know, I think Peter Milligan has been hit or miss for a lot of people, at least in the last couple of years. You know, I think his early work was just kind of made him a breakout star. And for some reason, he hasn't quite managed to retain that excitement for a lot of people. I've been a Peter Milligan fan for quite a while, and I've really enjoyed everything that he's done. I think he's done a lot of stuff at Valiant recently. And I'm glad to see him do this book, because I think this is the type of storytelling that Peter Milligan excels at. It's very trippy. It's a very trippy story. Basically, just to give you a gist of it, if you've never seen The Prisoner or you haven't read this book, this takes place in a place called The Village, which also seems to be some kind of espionage organization as well. And it's like the ultimate espionage organization, right? Almost kind of like the Illuminati, I guess, in some way. And it follows a spy who has broken out of working for MI6 after a fallout with him. And he gets, he's looking for Pandora. And when he discovers the secret of Pandora, which we still don't know what Pandora is, really, he wakes up in the village. And the organization in the village is trying to gain the information that he got from Pandora in order to use it for their own purposes. And I think that's a really interesting thing, because as we're seeing in this crazy interconnected world that we have, you know, it used to be that, like, money and oil and property and things like that were how you measured the amount of riches and power that you had, right? If you look back, like, ancient times, kings, like, you knew kings were rich when they had a ton of gold and a ton of slaves. Right, it was about property. Over the last few years, we've seen that change quite a bit, and you know, this has been in the news a lot, and that's why I talk about analog quite a bit, because it's a possible near future consequence of what we're seeing in real life nowadays. But we're seeing that, you know, data is the new money and gold and property. And it's not so much about money anymore. It's about having information on other people and other organizations, and being able to use that information to your advantage. So data is king right now. And this book really delves into that, of course, in this crazy spy thriller type story. And it's very trippy, because a lot of this book, in particular the second issue, the first issue was a lot more based in reality. Well, maybe. We don't know for sure. But we do have a lot of backstory there, so we assume it's reality. With the second issue, it's really hard to discern what is real and what isn't, because the village is kind of taking number two, or number six, excuse me, the spy that woke up in this place, and they're playing mind games with him to see if they can get him to reveal information, in particular by using people that he already knew from his previous life as a way to get him to reveal information. And you know, when the book starts off, there's this weird, like, trial thing going on where he is put on trial and his quote-unquote friends are there to help him get out of the situation. Of course, it turns out that none of that is real, right? He's got these electrodes bumped into his brain. Supposedly, he escapes from that and manages to get out of the village with his friends as he's being chased by villagers and these weird, like, balloon droid things. In a double-decker bus, of course, because that's the best way to escape a place, in a double-decker bus. Of course, based on the stuff that happens, I assume that even that escape is also happening in his brain, and that's something that I really like about this. I mean, the issue is called The Uncertainty Machine, so I'm assuming that none of this is actually happening, but I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of character development, tons of action in this book, And I think the art is really, really great. It does give you a little bit of that callback to the 60s, but it's told in a very much in a modern type storytelling. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. And that's The Prisoner from Titan Comics. I'm going to give that a 4 out of 5 as well. I'm really, really digging this series, and I hope that more people pick it up. I know that Titan maybe doesn't get a whole lot of press, at least in mainstream comic circles, and that's why I usually try to pick at least every couple weeks one of the Titan books, because they really do some very interesting stuff. Next up, let's go to Aftershock Comics, and this is Pestilence, A Story of Satan number 1. This is written by Frank Thierry with art by Oleg Okunev, and colors by Rob Schwaggy P. Schwager, and letters by Marshall Dillon. And of course, when we record Aftershock Central, I'll be going much more in depth on this book. So if what I say in this episode interests you, then be sure to check that out. The episode will be out sometime later this week. This is, of course, volume 2 of Pestilence. And just to give you a quick gist of what the story is about, it deals with the era of the Black Plague. And of course, for anyone that knows history, knows that the majority of the population in Europe was decimated by the Black Plague, and it caused a lot of changes in European society at that time, because a lot of people were dying. And I can't remember what the exact number, but I want to say like a third maybe or half of Europe just died from this disease. And the disease is not gone, by the way. There is still Black Plague in the world today, just not to the extent that... not to the extent that it caused in the Middle Ages. Of course, this being a comic, and this being Frank Thierry, who is absolutely amazing. He's one of those guys that just writes whatever he wants to write and does not give two Fs. And I think that's pretty obvious from this issue. And from Volume 1 as well. In this story, the Black Plague isn't necessarily a disease. It is caused... well, as we learn from this issue, by Satan. But basically, it turns people into zombies. And I know people are kind of maybe worn out of zombie stories, and that's fine if you are. But I highly recommend you pick Pestilence up. You really don't need to know what's going on in the first volume to pick the story up. I think this issue does a pretty good job at sort of explaining who the main characters of the story are. And the majority of the characters from the first volume do show back up in this issue. So it is self-contained. However, I do recommend at least browsing through the first volume to get the full story, because I think there was a lot of great character development. There was a lot of setup in the relationship between the central characters, this pestilence outbreak, and what role the church played in it. Because, of course, one thing that we know from Middle Age politics is that the church was very much involved in politics at the time. And part of the reason that this pestilence comes about is one of the cardinals uses it in order to, is dethrone the Pope a term? I don't know. If it is, we just made it. He uses it to dethrone the Pope and become Pope himself. And of course, this guy is not a very nice guy, as you can imagine. And he shows back up in this issue. What Pestilence, A Story of Satan does really well is kind of up the ante from Volume 1. So at the end of the first volume, pretty much we have these knights going around Europe, curing people of the zombie plague that was there. Okay, and they use it because they find the Holy Grail, right? The chalice that contained the blood of Christ. And they use it to kind of disperse holy water onto these people. And the holy water cures them of the zombie virus. Well, as we learn from this new volume, they maybe didn't cure the outbreak. Maybe there was just a temporary cure. Because, as we see here, Satan himself comes out from the bowels of hell, inhabits one of the characters from Volume 1, who has kind of created a cult around him with people that were zombies and were cured of the zombie virus. And I like that because it adds a new, fresh element to zombie mythology. And being a huge zombie movie buff, I have seen this kind of story before. I'm trying to think what it was. There was two different shows called The Departed that were really fantastic that deal with post-zombies, okay, people that are cured from zombieism and how society deals with them. There's a new movie coming out that I can't remember the name of it that also has vibes of this. It's got Ellen Page as the main character in that one. But it was a really interesting way to bring the zombie virus back with Satan himself showing up and inhabiting the body of this man and reawakening the zombie virus within his entire following. And of course, part of the reason that he brings the virus back is because he wants to go after the knights that cure the virus in the first place. And one of them, the main character, he has been kind of in seclusion for years since the first outbreak. And, you know, at the end of that one, his wife was pregnant, so now they have a son. He just kind of likes to hang out in the woods with his son and go fishing and things like that. And unfortunately, his friends come back to tell him about the resurgence of the pestilence. And, well, in the end, the zombies come after him. So I really enjoyed it. The art is just incredible also. I don't even know what to describe it to. In many respects, it reminds me of like the cliffhanger line of books that Wildstorm had in the, I want to say, 90s. It might have been into the 2000s. I think it was into the 2000s. They had, what was on there? Danger Girl, Crimson, Battle Chasers, and I want to say there was another one. But it's that kind of art style where it's a little cartoony and grotesque, but it's very clean and polished. And I think that kind of line work works really well for a horror type story. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. So if you want to try something new, something different, something that's not superheroes, that's a ton of fun with a lot of violence, and really there's quite a bit of profanity. Not so much, I think, in this issue. Volume 1 had a little bit more. But thoroughly enjoyed Pestilence, the Story of Satan, number 1. This is a 5 out of 5 for me. Because I just love it. I've loved every issue of the first series, and I'm extremely happy to see that this book is back. From there, let's go into Image Comics, and this is going to be The Last Siege, written by Landry Q. Walker, with art by Justin Greenwood, colors by Eric Jones, and letters by Patrick Brousseau. And this is, I'm trying to think how it was explained and solicited. I don't have it in front of me, and I can't remember. But it's sort of a fantasy story set in like a Game of Thrones type world. And I'm not sure how much magic there's going to be in this particular story, because in this first issue, there is no magic. It's pretty much straight up a fantasy story with a medieval setting. And we do meet this one stranger who shows up at a bar and has this fight with the current lord of the town. He gets his butt kicked, but kind of on purpose, and then pulls out this letter that, hey, I'm the new guy in charge of this place. You just kicked my butt. You need to get the hell out of here. So that was kind of cool. It for those of you that have seen Into the Badlands, this first issue of The Last Siege kind of reminded me of that. Now, Into the Badlands is a little bit different because that is a post-apocalyptic TV show. But the cool thing about it is that it's very much inspired by, like, Eastern history. So, like, I remember watching Into the Badlands, and in many ways it reminded me of, like, a westernized, like, samurai film in some ways. And a lot of the topics that they discuss, the way that the culture is set up, is very much, I think, inspired by, in particular, like, Japanese history, like Edo period Japan. And I'll love that kind of stuff. And I did get that vibe a little bit from The Last Siege, because the main character is just like, when he first appears, he's in this hood. You can't see his face or anything. But when he actually starts to get into this bar fight with this other lord, he, like, pulls the hood off, and he's wearing, like, it looks like a very modern outfit, but he's got this awesome katana sword that he uses to fight, and I really enjoyed it. It looks like, I'm not sure if this is a miniseries or an ongoing, and I guess nowadays it doesn't matter because probably everything's a miniseries, but I like the world. I like the world. There's a lot about politics in here, or how the politics work in this world. And I should actually probably be more clear on that, because this is not a political book in any way, shape, or form. What has happened is there's a new king ruling this realm, and you know, things are a little weird in this place because I guess people don't kind of know where they should be based on the fact that they have a new king. And this is a place that has been ravaged by war for many, many years. You know, they haven't said how long, but it looks like maybe a generation of war at least. And everyone's tired and everyone just wants to kind of get over it. But, you know, being a middle age type inspired story, you know, politics takes into effect quite a bit. Because, you know, back then, when a place was taken over, you would marry off like the royalty from the previous kingship into the new people ruling the place. And there's a lot of talk of that here, because it's a girl that's supposed to be married off to this lord that gets his butt kicked in the end. So I really liked it. There's I think for a first issue, it does a pretty damn good job at establishing the world and what we can expect from all these characters. But of course, it doesn't dive very deep into who these people are. In particular, this mysterious stranger that is apparently sent there to rule the city. So we'll see how it goes. I am very much looking forward to the next issue of The Last Siege. I think this is going to be a little less appealing than some of the other books that I'll be discussing on this episode. But if you like that kind of middle-aged history, like fantasy, Game of Thrones type stuff, then I think you'll really dig this first issue of The Last Siege. For me, it's going to be a 3.5 out of 5. And again, that's The Last Siege number 1 from Image Comics. From there, let's go all the way over to IDW and talk about Judge Dredd Under Siege. I'm going to talk about this really briefly. Judge Dredd is one of those books that has been coming out for forever. And I've had this real passionate love for Judge Dredd over the last few months. I can't remember how it is that I came upon it. I want to say somehow Nick and I were talking about it on the Nerdy Legion podcast, and I went and picked up some books, and I loved them, and I picked up pretty much every single thing that IDW has put out over the last few years. I now own. I've gone back and started picking up some of the 2000 AD stuff as well. I really love it. And I think the stuff that IDW has done with Judge Dredd is absolutely fantastic. It is true to the original source material, but it updates the art. The art is gorgeous. Every single issue, it's beautiful. And I can't remember, I should look this up. Max Dunbar does the art in Under Siege. And I don't know, he's got to be one of the guys that was regularly working on the ongoing as well, because the art looks very familiar. And if not, then he does a fantastic job at copying that art style. This is written by Mark Russell, who I absolutely adore as well. And I think he really nails the atmosphere of Mega City, and he really nails the way that Judge Dredd speaks, the way he deals with people, how he understands the law. I really loved it. Basically, Judge Dredd is called into the Patrick Swayze block. And for those of you that don't know, in this city, everything's divided into blocks. So if you're in the UK, you might be familiar with this. The blocks are kind of like what we would call the projects in the US. They're buildings, giant buildings with tons of people in them, sometimes like groups of buildings. And they're all very much their own town in a way, right? Like they each have somebody that rules that building. They have their own politics. It's like if you ever played SimCity, you remember like Acropolis, maybe? You would build, when you got to the future, you would build these things where it would hold like 200,000 people, and they were completely self-contained buildings with their own power and malls and residential area and business area and things like that. That's pretty much the world of Judge Dredd. And this is the Patrick Swayze block. Now, how that came about, I don't know, but I loved it. I thought it was awesome. And Patrick Swayze block has been taken over by the mutants, who don't live inside Mega City. They live outside the walls. But the Patrick Swayze block has this tunnel that connects them to the outside of the wall section of the city, because that's how they were dumping out all their sewage. And, you know, this Patrick Swayze block didn't quite work out the way it was supposed to. They were supposed to have like their own self-contained organic farm and their own power plant, things like that. And none of that kind of came into fruition. So the block kind of started declining in popularity. And the way that they made money to support the block was to sell space in the sewage system, basically. They would let other blocks dump their sewage in their sewage system, and then that would go out into the outside world. Well, because it's connected to the outside, the mutants that live in the wastelands outside the city were able to get into the tunnel, and they have taken over this block. That's pretty much the setup of this. Now, Judge Benny shows up in here, and the reason that Judge Dredd shows up at the Patrick Swayze block is because Judge Benny has disappeared. And he goes to try to find her, and it turns out that she is still alive. They connect to try to fight the mutants. While the story progresses, they do come upon some other people that lived in the block, and together they decide to mount a defense against the mutants. Obviously, there's a lot going on in here. I think even if you're not very familiar with Judge Dredd history and stories, then this is a really good jump on point. I think for the most part, anytime IDW does a miniseries of some sort, they do really do a good job at kind of giving you setup in the beginning. And you're not going to get the entire story of this place. And to be honest, I think a lot of the time it doesn't really matter, because very quickly you learn what matters. It's Judge Dredd and his relationship to the world. And so when you see things, you kind of see it through his eyes. And maybe it skews the world a little bit in some ways, but he's got a very interesting perspective on what it is to be in this place. And I think this issue in particular does a really good job at explaining Dredd's role with the law, really what all the judges do, and you know, the history of this place that we learn about, the Patrick Swayze block. So thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. Judge Dredd is really one of my favorite things to read. Whenever there's a new series, I always try to pick it up. And I'm thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying this first issue of Judge Dredd Under Siege. This will be a 4-issue miniseries, and again, that's from IDW. I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5. All right, let's move on from there to Dark Horse Comics. And this is going to be Blackwood number 1. This will also be a 4-issue miniseries, written by the horror master himself, Evan Dorkin, with art by Veronica Fish. And God, this is so good. I just love this. This is sort of an H.P. Lovecraftian type story. I guess maybe somewhat inspired by Harry Potter, but sorry, Harry Potter fans, not as dumbed down as Harry Potter. Now, before you send me hate mail, don't do that at Geekvine, by the way, if you want to send it. What I mean to say by that is this doesn't feel as young adult as Harry Potter does. Okay, so maybe saying dumbed down was not the right way to do it. But this is a school, maybe a magic school. There's definitely magical stuff happening here. What that is, we don't know yet. We do know that the headmaster of the school, the dean of the school, is involved in some rituals. We do know that the school has some secrets behind it that may be connected to these magical rituals. We know there's a ton of cemeteries in the town where they're at. We know that there's some magical spirits that show up towards the end, including maybe a little octopus-type monster thing growing out of somebody's back. I don't know. I love Evan Dorkin stuff. I've been a fan of his for quite a while. He's one of those guys that has a very rabid following, I think, but definitely not a mainstream-type following. I do love horror books, of course. I talk about that all the time, and I think this one in particular is really interesting to me, because what I see in a lot of horror books now is that they do a lot more in-your-face horror, right? And maybe some of that is like psychological-type horror, like Infidel, for example. But it's more about in-your-face, like, here's the monster type thing. And the mysteries don't often last multiple issues, even if there's an overarching mystery in the storyline. So we see this with like Harrow County, Infidel. I've talked about Teether recently. Quite a few things like that. This book does that a little bit differently. In fact, if you're a fan of like Lock and Key, for example, I think this will be a book that really interests you, because in many ways, the type of story that this tells is somewhat similar to Lock and Key. With the difference being that I think Lock and Key took quite a few issues for the story to really kick off and become interesting. Whereas in Blackwood, I think Evan Dorkin does a really good job at establishing all the key characters, kind of what the magical mystery is, and just makes it for a really compelling story. I've really, really enjoyed this. You know, again, it's a horror book, but I often like horror where you don't see the monster, right? And, you know, I've talked about, like, Alien, for example, in the past. A lot of people, Alien, the movie from 78, I think, 79, is a sci-fi story. And sure it is. It's in the future. There's, you know, space travel, things like that. But at its heart, what made the original Alien film great is that it's a horror story. And what makes it a great horror story is that you don't see the impending threat until the end, right? You know, I talk smack about Jaws, for example, on other podcasts. And the big reason I talk smack about it is because I know that people really love Jaws. And, you know, it makes kind of for good comedy bits, especially on the Nerd Legion podcast, when I make fun of Jaws. Jaws is a fine movie. You know, it's not my favorite movie, but I think it's a good movie. And what makes Jaws really good is the fact that you don't see the shark until the end, right? Which is really interesting, because if they had made it the way they originally intended to make the film, you would see a ton of the shark. And that, of course, would not make it as interesting or horrifying, because you see the monster. And that's what makes Blackwood really good, because you do see hints of things, but you never actually see the thing until the very end. And I'm not even convinced that, like, that's ultimately the big bad thing either. But all the characters are extremely different, they're very varied, and this school itself is a great mystery, right? Because as we learn, none of the kids that show up to start the semester at this Blackwood University are particularly adept at anything, right? Like, they don't have good grades, they don't really play sports, they're all kind of losers. You know, some people are, like, really into, like, new agey magic stuff, some people could care less. There's a guy with, like, an eye patch, and we don't know why. But they obviously all have some kind of deep psychological issues that maybe they have dealt with at some point. In fact, one of the characters, Ren, she's got white hair, and she kind of one of the girls is asking her about her hair. She's like, oh, yeah, all my friends died, and I watched them all die, and so my hair turned white. Well, as we learn later on, like, that may actually be the story, right? She wasn't just being a B-word to this other girl. So that has me very curious to know more about these characters. In some ways, this is also a little bit like the original Scooby-Doo cartoon. And, you know, that was a little campy. It was for kids. It was humorous. And there's some humor in Blackwood, number one, but not a whole lot. But in many ways, it reminds me of that, right? Like, you have a Scooby gang solving this mystery. And, you know, you have monsters that may or may not be actual monsters. We'll see. You know, this is only the first issue, but I love this book so much. I was extremely pleased that this came out, and I'm glad that Dark Horse is taking a chance with another horror book. And this one's just fantastic. So if you're a fan of any of the things that I said, if you love, God, I've said so many things. If you love Scooby-Doo, pick this up. If you look Harry Potter's, pick this up. If you like, what else did I say? Lock and Key, pick this up. It's really good. It's really good. And I think the art really shines in this book. I'm used to Veronica Fish more from the Archie books, but I think the way that there's just something different about her style in this book, and I think it works really, really well for this type of story. And I was surprised, because I didn't think it would work, but it totally did, and it's an absolutely beautiful book. So Blackwood number one from Dark Horse Comics is going to be, surprise, surprise, a 5 out of 5. I think that leaves only one book for this episode of Comic Talk Today, and that is going to be from Valiant Comics, Harbinger Wars 2, number 1. This is written by Matt Kent, with art by Tomas Chiarello, colors by Diego Rodriguez, and letters by Dave Sharp, another man who letters like a third of the books that come out every single month. This is, of course, the big summer event for Valiant Comics. This is somewhat a continuation from the original Harbinger Wars from, when did that come out, like 2013? Except this does directly tie into some of the stuff we've seen recently, in particular the Secret Weapons miniseries that Eric Heiserer and Raul Allen and Patricia Martin were doing, which is absolutely fantastic. It's a beautiful book, just not just the storytelling, but the page layouts, the art itself, it's brilliant. If you're listening to this and you're not a Valiant fan, I highly, highly recommend you go check out Secret Weapons. I would say it was probably one of my favorite books of last year from any publisher. And granted, I may be a little biased because I do love Valiant Comics, but even with the level of output that Valiant has had, Secret Weapons was above and beyond anything else that they were doing. So, of course, this follows immediately from that. And to kind of spoil the story a little bit, in Secret Weapons, Livewire, who, we're not going to get to the whole history. It's a little complicated. But she's a very powerful Psi-Yet, right? So she's got these abilities to control technology. And she found this group of kids that were kind of discarded from a Psi-Yet program because their abilities weren't that cool, right? Like one girl could talk to birds. One guy could just like make things appear out of nowhere, except he had no control of it. One guy could turn to stone. Like they weren't cool abilities. But as we learned, as they became a team, as they were kind of tutored by Livewire, they were able to find great uses for those abilities and kind of learn to control them. Well, the problem was that there was a corporation, Omen, that wanted to control these kids, because there's always a corporation trying to control superpower beings in any single comic book universe ever. And Omen is now that company. Now, of course, Omen has government contracts and this and that, and that didn't sit well with Livewire. And so she kind of went on the run with her team. They've connected with the Renegades, who were the original Psi-Yet team from Harbinger, if you read that when it premiered, I believe, 2012, or maybe 2013 also. That was Josh Dysart, and God, is that good. That's so good. All 25 issues are amazing. This pits Livewire and the Psi-Yets, including her secret weapons, against the government, basically. So we have GATE, that's the organization led by Colonel Capshaw, who also is the group with which ExoManowar works for. And the reason he works for them is they kind of carved out a place for his Visigoth people in Nebraska. So there's like a colony there. And so he works for them to make sure that they're protected and safe. They also have connections to MI6 in England. And of course, Ninjak works for MI6. They also have connections to the Hardcore. And so we see Palmer show up in this as well. So it's kind of a who's who of the Valiant universe. And while this is all going on, we have Peter Stanchek, who at one point became Space Jesus and then came back. And he's super powerful, a very powerful Psi-Yet with amazing mental abilities. And one of his abilities is the power to activate the Psi-Yet abilities within people. So he's going around North America, activating kids left and right to prepare for this war, right? Because they know that the government is amassing resources with the help of Omen to try to stop them. Now, the way that this whole thing played out was interesting. I think it played out pretty well for a first issue. I highly, highly enjoyed it. I love seeing Livewire take such a lead role within not just the team, but within the Valiant universe, because she's always been such a strong female character. And once she kind of became more self-aware and confident in her abilities, she really became a standout character on her own. And she's, of course, kind of like the leader of the rebellion here against Omen and the government. And, you know, we can assume that Omen and the government are the bad guys. And it does seem that way from what we've seen in recent stories and from what we see here, right? Because, like, Omen's setting up these, like, mobile cities where Psi-Yets can go and be safe from persecution. But, of course, we know that's not true, right? Like, they want to use them as weapons. And the world kind of believes Omen, because Omen has always been one of these companies that does good for humanity. But we've seen this kind of thing in the past, right? We had Toya Harada, that is his Harbinger Foundation, and he was doing great for the world also, you know, creating new technologies, creating new science, applying it to different places, giving destitute countries technology and hope for a better future. And of course, all that kind of went downhill when the Renegades outed the fact that he was a Psi-Yet and all the other stuff that he was doing in the background. So really his philanthropy was to fund all his experiments. Omen's kind of the same way, except as far as we know, this is not being led by Psi-Yets. This is just strictly a human thing. And what I like about that is it gives me callbacks of like late 80s X-Men stories. I mean, really, you can go back as far as the 60s, right, with the X-Men. Because the X-Men was always kind of like an analogy for race relations in the U.S. But things got really interesting when you start bringing in like the Sentinels, and you had all these groups that are like hunting mutants. You have like very pro-humanity movements that want to get rid of mutants because they're not like us kind of thing. And this is, of course, very pertinent to today because we have a lot of that in American culture today. This is, of course, a comic, though, and I think the one thing about Matt Kent is that he does a great job at not bringing politics into the stories, even if it is influenced in some ways by current events. But, you know, this first issue was it was an interesting setup. I want to say it was a little wordier than I'm used to from Valiant Comics, but there was plenty of action in there as well. And I think the thing about Valiant is Valiant always makes sure that every first issue reads like a first issue, right? Because being a small indie publisher, there's always new people jumping onto their storylines. And you never want to burden new readers with a ton of backstory. But, you know, Valiant does a great job at that. They always have little character bios at the beginning. You have kind of like a here's how we got here type paragraph beforehand. Throughout the story, there's a lot of, like, this is where this character's been, and this is how the character got here. But not in a way where regular, dedicated fans would feel like, oh my god, here we go again with this recap thing. It's never like that. Valiant does a really good job at that, and I'm very happy for it. Overall, I did really enjoy it, and I gotta say, Tomas Giorello, like, this man, I don't know where he came from, but his art style is absolutely brilliant. He did some fantastic work for Valiant previously. He did 4001 War Mother for them, the miniseries. He recently had an arc or two on Exo Manowar. He just did an arc on Ninja K as well. His art is just beautiful, and it fits really, really, really well, this book. So I'm happy that they picked him as the artist. I do like the way that the factions have separated here. So basically we have Livewire and the Secret Weapons. We got Peter Stanchek and the Renegades, and Bloodshot, who obviously played a big role in the first Harbinger War series and will obviously play a big one in here as well. Although it seems like he's almost zombie-like in this one. I don't want to say that because he was a total badass when he showed up. But Livewire talks about the fact that she can communicate with his nanites in his blood. And I thought that was interesting because it almost seemed like she was using Bloodshot as a soldier, where he may not be necessarily 100% acting of his own free will. We'll see if that actually ends up being the case. It's kind of hard to tell from this first issue. On the other side, we have Gate, of course, Exo Manowar, Ninjak, and Charlie Palmer, and the Hardcore. We do see a couple of new Hardcore members to show up on here. I love the way that that they talk about neutralizing the Psyots, because the Hardcore are kind of following mutants into this safe place that Peter and Faith and the Renegades have built, the safe house. But they're tracking all of them, right? They can track every single one of these Psyots as soon as Peter activates them. And I can't remember what the exact phrasing is, but like, should we go in and neutralize? Like, things like that. Very much like politically correct military speak, I guess you could say. Because obviously they just want to go in there and kill these kids. And they can't quite say that. I guess when you change the phrasing, it maybe makes you feel a little bit better about it. Anyways, I really enjoyed this first issue. I want to see where the rest of the series will go. I'm a little sad that Eric Heiser is not going to be involved with the story, which originally he was planned to be. But I do like the fact that the Secret Weapons kids are continuing in the Valiant universe and being such a big part of this story. I love Livewire. She's just an amazing character, and I'm extremely happy that Valiant is putting her finally at the forefront of the universe. I think they need more of that. And really, really dug it. Really dug it. So if you're a Valiant fan, obviously you're probably going to be checking this out. If you're not, I highly recommend you check out the Harbinger Wars 2 miniseries for this coming summer. It'll be a monthly book, and unlike other publishers, it'll just be a self-contained four-issue miniseries. Very much looking forward to seeing how the rest of this book develops, and whether or not they're going to be tying some of the storyline here into all these movies that they're apparently working on. So, Harbinger Wars 2, issue 1, is going to be a 4 out of 5 for me as well. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And again, that's from Valiant Comics. I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Man, this went longer than I thought it was going to. Hope you enjoyed it. I will be back tomorrow with the news. And of course, because it's the day before New Comic Book Day, I will do the Comic Predictor segment. If you want to get in touch with me, Twitter is the best place. @GeekVine is where you can find me. ComicTalkToday@gmail.com is the email address. And I will catch you then.